I didn't recognize their importance until later.
Well, it must have been.
I was just an anonymous civilian there, but
it must have been funny for you later.
Yeah, later. Alexander Haig, I saw a number of times. I think he was in charge of what's it called, a room plows, knocking down the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
He's a skinny lieutenant colonel. And I found out later that we could have had a lot in common because he was raised on the Philadelphia main line. He was Irish, German extraction.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I've listened to his briefings and I've talked to him several times about this and that. And same with Schwarzkopf. I met him up in a place called Bongsong. I doubt if he'd remember me, but he was a lieutenant colonel, I think, up there that involved in, I think, Rome plows or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'd known they were going to become famous, then I would have
latched onto him, maybe.
No, not really.
What kind of a guy was Schwarzkopf when you came across him?
He was a remarkable guy. He's not, you know, some people are outstanding and you know it when you meet him.
Sure.
He was one, and Alexander Haig, too.
Uh-huh.
They were good officers. Yes, they were.
What about General Wayand, who, of course, was
Wayand,
above you?
I liked Wayand very much.
Yeah, he was...
The guy before him was Abrams, and Abrams was gruff and...
tough guy.
And tough, yeah, and I didn't feel comfortable. And I doubt if he remembers me, but Wayand was a gentleman.
Tell me more about him.
Well, I didn't know much about him except that he and Van were very close because Van was his advisor.
Sure.
And a few times I met him and briefed him. He was a gentleman and he asked decent questions and didn't try to embarrass me or anything.
Mm-hmm.
He was a nice man. Westmoreland... I didn't like because I knew he didn't like Van, and I liked Van.
that was reasonable.
And I thought Westmoreland had a lot of fortuitous circumstances. It elevated him to where he was because he's so good looking.
You think that was the main driving?
Well, I think it doesn't help. It doesn't hurt anybody to be handsome and
tall,
particular. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He no doubt was an outstanding man too, but just because he didn't like Van, I didn't like him. I was a Van loyalist.
Yeah. excuse me, Al. How long did you actually stay over there in Three Corps as the refugee operations director?
I'd say from '66 until '70. Mm-hmm.
Until 1970.
And I finished out my tour, whatever it was, and I went back home, and I was teaching school again.
Right.
And I'd forgotten all about Vietnam, or I didn't consider. And one day, out of the blue, I get a letter from Van saying he's been moved to Two Corps, and he'd like me to come back as his refugee advisor. And... I talked over with my wife and kids, and they were all for it. They said, "Daddy, we want to," because I was told my family could move anywhere they wanted. The State Department would pay for the move, and they could live in Taipei or Hong Kong or Manila or Tokyo or any place. And they all wanted to live in Taipei, China. I asked for China, and they gave me a beautiful home in China. We lived in a big, beautiful home up on a hill behind Taipei, a place called Peito, which is the garden spot of the Orient for the Japanese, in a mountainous area, and it's where they film all the Chinese films. My kids went to the Chinese American school and learned a lot of Chinese. And when your kids finished school, you could send them anywhere in the world for further training. And my wife had her own Chinese cook, masseuse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was gracious living. My wife belonged to the State Department's Ladies Club and often had lunch and dinner with Madame Chiang Kai-shek. And,
really? Mm-hmm.
And a lot of her friends were Indian Maharanis. One of them gave her a beautiful scarf that was heavy because it was loaded with gold thread. And it was an interesting... for the wife and kids, in a way. But so many of the women spent their time in frivolous pursuits and going to the club and playing the slot machines. Some became alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And they all were getting reports that their husbands were misbehaving with the Vietnamese girls and whatnot. And so there were a lot of the women there who were frustrated and unhappy and just killing time. But it was gracious living.
Did you go back there much, Al?
Yes.
How often?
Every 10 weeks I could go home for 2 weeks.
Okay.
And my wife, in fact, had come to Vietnam. And, you know, like Christmas and places, times like that.
Uh-huh.
And I have movies of this. This time I was up in bloody Binh Dinh, in a very bad province.
Mm-hmm.
And she got to Saigon somehow or another, and I couldn't get down to Saigon. There's nobody to meet her. But somebody finally, thank God, took her in tow and got her up to Binh Dinh, where we spent some time. I took her out to some of these villages where I worked, and there's one up near Binh K. While I had her in the village, we got word that the VC squad was closing in and to get the hell out of there. And we flew out under an artillery barrage. We flew down the bed of the river, and I got her back to Quy Nhon. And next day I went back to this village where I had my dear wife, and shortly after we left, they killed about 18 VC in around that village. But I got photographs of her on that day, flying out on the bed of the river.
Mm-hmm.
Another time, I lived in a trailer there, and there was an air conditioner at the far end of the trailer, and the bedroom was the back end of the trailer. A mortar landed nearby, and a concussion blew the air conditioner on, slid it down, down the floor, and banged on the side of her bed. And the VC used to get up on the mountain behind the town and lob mortars into the town. Then the gunships, this was a nightly occurrence, and then the gunships would come over, and at nighttime it looks like somebody has a red water hose just watering down the area. And what you're seeing is every sixth bullet is a tracer bullet. But the gunships would come in and look like somebody with a red hose was hosing down the mountain.
Wow.
And
now, was this Binh Dinh province?
Binh Dinh, mm-hmm. And Quy Nhon.
Quy Nhon. Mm-hmm.
And my wife was fascinated. We were watching an outdoor movie in an army camp nearby, and mortars landed nearby, and artillery went off. And she was kind of fascinated by everything that was going on.
Did she get rattled?
No.
Really?
No. She really didn't know. She'd never seen the ragged end of shrapnel, what it does. Once you see that, you shake you up for good, I guess. But, no, she wasn't too perturbed. Then she helped me.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I was delivering supplies to a lot of orphanages. So she was good with kids and the nuns and whatnot, and we'd go out to the orphanages. And I've got pictures of her helping me in the orphanages. Yeah.
She sounds like a pretty special gal.
Oh, she was. Yeah. God love her.
Yeah.
I came home from the gym one day and found her dead in the bed.
Had she had a heart attack or something?
Yeah. Well, her aorta. We found out it's genetic. Her father and all three brothers died at the same time. And this aorta gives away.
How old was she? When did that happen, Al?
That happened in 19... I've been married for 8 years now, and it happened probably about 2 years
before that.
About 79, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right?
No,
97.
Okay.
The last day we spent together, she had a good friend who was in not a nursing home, but a retirement home nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And she invited this friend over for dinner on Sunday, and she said, you do the salad, and I'll do the rest. And we did. And this woman was such a delightful personality. We spent all day talking.
Mm-hmm.
She was a very nice lady, a widow lady.
Mm-hmm.
And towards evening, Chris said, I have to take so-and-so back to the nurse, to the retirement home. I'll be back in a few minutes. She came back. And I was watching a TV program, but she wanted to watch another one.
Mm-hmm.
And said, do you want me to cook you some popcorn before I go upstairs and watch TV? And I said, no, thanks. And that's the last I ever saw her alive. But during the night, I heard her get up. And that's what I heard her get up. Next morning, I always get up every morning at 5, and I go to the gym. Those days I was playing racquetball for an hour and swimming for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd come up to the gym at 8. I'd leave the gym about 8, 8:10, and she'd come up because she had to get coffee for her girlfriend. So I saw her every morning in passing. And if I didn't see her in the club, I'd see her on her way to the club every morning. This one morning, she didn't show up at the club. And I said, I'll see her on the road. And I didn't see her on the road, and I got home and I saw the car in the driveway. And I knew immediately something was wrong. I went in the house and yelled, "Grace!" And, of course, silence. And I found her dead in bed. And evidently she had got up in the night to take a tumble. She must have felt uneasy. And she died peacefully in her sleep, the coroner said, because she still had the tongue on her tongue, and the covers were pulled up her chin and weren't disheveled. She just died in her sleep.
She just fell asleep.
I consider a reward for a very good life.
Yes, sir. She sounds like a wonderful person who served her country. She served her country.
Yes, yes. No, Grace was a fine wife and mother.
And I think she probably felt very lucky to have you, sir.
Not really.
I'll bet she did.
A lot of people say the thing that saved our marriage was the fact I was gone so long.
Well, sometimes that's what works for people.
Yeah, but I'd say we had as good a marriage as anybody I know. But I wish now that I didn't go to Vietnam and be as gone as long as I was.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I came home every 3 months, that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And it was harder on her than on me because she was there with the teenage kids, you know, and I was there doing my thing and not bothered much about
what's going on at home.
Going on at home. Mm-hmm. Well, I was concerned. Like Van, I knew Van had a family. It was all screwed up.
Right.
But they had more reason to be screwed up. My kids were not screwed up.
You mentioned yesterday that you hadn't known a whole bunch of dimensions to what John Van was involved in until you read A Bright Shining Light.
No, I knew John. I knew a little bit about John Van.
You had an idea?
I had an idea, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was a woman that lived in this house who was supposed to be the housemaid, but I imagine.
Probably.
No. Uh-huh. But there are so many people over there that fell in that category that he just didn't. I ran across people over there who had been brain surgeons and got tired of being brain surgeons and became pilots for Air America. I ran across men who had been priests who now had mistresses.
Uh-huh.
You ran across, and you just didn't. It wasn't too wise to get too nosy because who knows who's doing what to whom.
Right.
It was none of my business. But
right.
I knew Van on a daily basis, and we laughed and joked and got along. I think one reason he hired me was that he kind of liked me.
Mm-hmm.
He probably suspected that I would do the things that he hoped I would do, and I did. And so we got along fine.
And so well that he actually called you back when he went back.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And Al, were you over there when he was killed?
No. I'd left before that time. I'll tell you something interesting about that.
Yeah.
There's still speculation. Well, maybe I shouldn't even, because this is kind of a conspiracy sort of theory. It's probably, I can't prove anything, but
it might be of interest in the future, though, that people talked about these things.
Van was killed when the North Vietnamese came, were coming down from Tan Khom, and,
mm-hmm.
and Van had his own personal helicopter, and Van was notorious for taunting the Viet Cong and the VC and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
and he was probably cowboying around or doing just that, maybe, but also he out near, I forget the name of the village, it's in my book, but the Mountain Yard villages had like totem poles in some areas, and he hit one of those poles, and that was the end of Van, or so I thought. And about when I was, after I left Vietnam, I was teaching school. I was called in the office one day and said, "There's a young Vietnamese guy here who wants to talk to you." And it turned out it was a Van's, what's the French you call him? Aide de camp.
Mm-hmm.
who went in and recovered Van's body.
Really?
Yeah. And I asked him, who killed Van? Because some people, I think the Viet Cong claimed they did
it. Yes, that's right.
And the North Vietnamese claimed they did it. And Van, General Zhu was the general in charge of the Central Highlands at one time. And Zhu was involved in a lot of things that, I think his father would get a hold of heroin and bring it up in the, up around Quy Nhon, and it was distributed to the NCOs and whatnot, to distribute to GS, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard about it, same time everybody else did. The next thing I knew, Van was defending Zhu. And later on, I asked Van, I said, isn't Zhu involved? He said, yeah. I said, but I didn't let it be known because he's after Zhu for other reasons. And I thought, what Zhu wanted to do was get a hold of the Mountain Yard lands that were full of timber and whatnot. And I thought, and I soon forgot it because narcotics I knew about, but considered none of my business. But this young army captain said he didn't know what happened, but he said it might have been the South Vietnamese might have done it. And I never thought of that before.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the one that recovered Van's body.
What made him think that? Did he tell you?
I don't know.
He just had an idea of it.
Yeah.
It's certainly a mystery.
When Van started the Office of Highland Affairs, so we're going with Mountain Yards.
Uh-huh.
And Zhu didn't think much of that idea because Zhu was about like Custer and the Sioux Indians. You know, he didn't have their best interests at heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, Al, let me ask you a little bit more about the Mountain Yards. You spent a great deal of time with these, with this minority group and some of the sub-minorities, the ethnic minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you brought us was that wonderful flag,
mm-hmm.
which you said you carried around. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yeah, they're a group of young... people think of Mountain Yards as being unsophisticated savages, but they aren't. There's a lot of, especially among the Rade, who lived down near Bonny Tuit, and had the advantage of going to high school, and some even went to college somewhere or another. And there was a group of Mountain Yard intellectuals who, when the French were there, founded an organization called Forces United League Races Oppressed, I think it was called, which was a group formed by the Mountain Yards to oppose oppression from the people in charge, be it Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, anywhere the Mountain Yards.
Mm-hmm.
And the 4-0 was an organization that if the Vietnamese found out you belonged to it, it would be like somebody finding out you were a member of the Communist Party back in the 50s. It was that, it was not a good idea.
The South Vietnamese as well, not just VC.
No, South Vietnamese.
South Vietnamese particularly.
I didn't know what the North Vietnamese thought. But I understand that the people who were non-Mountain Yards, were few number who were brought into the full organization. And I think Dr. Hickey was one of them, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Van and I were two. And there may have been others, maybe some Green Berets.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't. There weren't too many of them. But when the word got out to anybody as a Mountain Yard that you were sympathetic to them, and you could show evidence by having in your possession that flag, your chances of being harmed were very slight, and your chances of being helped were very good. And you could go into areas that were hostile because they were working with the North Vietnamese and liked the North Vietnamese better than the South Vietnamese. But being a member of Full Row, you could do your thing and nothing would happen.
Did you carry that flag then?
I kept it all the time in a suitcase. And as soon as I landed in a strange place, I took it out and showed it to them.
And it worked like a passport? Key to the city?
When you see a gun sticking out of the side of a house,
mm-hmm.
when you take out your flag, the gun disappears.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. A couple times I was in areas I knew that were hostile, but once it was known that I had that flag. And not only that, the mountain yards, it took pretty good care of me, because if there was danger around, they'd let me know, Al, don't come here tomorrow because of this or that, or don't go down that road, it's mine, Boku Min, and that sort of thing. But they took care of me, and I had a lot of friends amongst the mountain yards, in all ages, men, women, children, and whatnot. And I was called various names, but in one mountain yard group I was called, I'm a plow patow type tohun, which means big hairy bear with no hair on his head. And some of the Vietnamese villages, they called me Ung Ya Ma Tin Zoi Dao. Ung Ya is old man, Mop is fat. Din is crazy. Zoi Dao, bald-headed, fat, crazy, bald-headed old man. But because Vietnamese is a tonal language, the way they say it means a lot.
Yes.
If I sometimes I just kid around with them, I'd say, "Chao Choi Hung Mok Kai, how about give me a kiss?" They go, "Yeah, you dirty old man." After they got to know me, they'd say, "Yeah," they make a motion of saying, "Yeah," which means that, you know, they accept you and they respect you, huh? And so I was known almost everywhere, Oh yeah. They'd like to see me arrive, and they were sad when I had to go, especially when I was going home. But I got to try, so I really could interrelate either. I took a course once in other languages, and there's ways of speaking other than speaking. It's mostly body language.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're with unsophisticated people, you know immediately whether they like you or hate you or whatever, because they do what they feel like doing. If they love you, they'll kick you and hug you and slobber all over you. And if they don't like you, they're that, you know, spit on you. But I learned a lot of pidgin, mountain yard and Vietnamese, and with pidgin and acting out, drawing pictures in the sand and dirt. You know, I could occupy myself all day. For example, when trying to move a village, you had to meet with the village elders and tell them why they should move, and they'd tell you why they shouldn't move because that mountain was their father, and their father didn't want to see their children go away, and so forth and so on. But they do a lot of things with their hands. The way you and I are sitting now is very offensive to many people in the world. You never really cross plenty of the other person.
Right.
And one thing that drove me nuts after I found out about it, the average American, when he has nothing to do, goes like this. You know, which is the nastiest thing you can do.
It has some stuff.
And here's some poor Vietnamese colonel with his American advisor, and the advisor said, "Now listen, Colonel, tomorrow morning we're going to do
it's just so offensive.
It'd be like me talking to you."
Mm-hmm.
But the mountain yards had a hand motion. I used to like it. They only do it when you're walking away from them. They go, "I hope a cobra bites you on the ass."
Is that what it actually means?
Yeah. They'd talk and they'd listen respectfully to somebody and turn his head and go. But a person who's empathetic to other people picks up all these nuances.
Sure.
And we were discussing philosophical problems. How many people were killed? How much roofing do we need? How much rice? And by drawing pictures in the sand and dirt, you could get ideas across. For example, when I was working up above Kontum around Doc Peck, I heard tanks at night. Well, I heard something.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know exactly what it was. And I'm sure that the intelligence people somewhere are picking this up, but back in Pleiku, I remember telling some guy, an army guy, that, you know, I'm hearing something out at night that sounds to me like it might be trucks or tanks. He said, oh, damn, there's nothing like that up there. Well, shortly thereafter, it was proven that there were tanks. But anyway, the mountain yards, when I asked the mountain yards, I hear these noises, they draw pictures in the sand, like a tank or whatnot. And I told them back in Pleiku, I was hearing tanks. Some people were incredulous at first, but it soon proved to be. They were up there.
Now, would this be in 72?
Yes.
Before the Easter Offensive?
Yes, I guess so.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, pretty soon tanks begin rolling down the Central Highland.
Right.
And there's one story that you can probably would know about or hear about eventually. I don't know if it's true or not. There's
uh-huh.
There's a place north of Kanton called Khan Harim. And it was to me, it was an oasis in the desert of death. Because the Belgian priests and nuns were taking care of all these orphan mountain yard children. And I was supplying them with wheat and other things as often as I could. And I always, like I say, felt like I was in an oasis of peace and love, because the Belgian priests and nuns were, I mean, if there are saints, these people seem to me to be saints. And I heard that when the North Vietnamese came down, I forget the Highway 14, passing Khan Harim, to go in to attack Khon Tum, that they crucified the priests and nuns and made women and children get on the tanks as they drove in to attack Khon Tum. And if they didn't get on the tank, they were shot. And if they went into Khon Tum and came under fire, they got shot. And it seems to me I read that in like Time or Newsweek too back in those days. I don't know if the story's true or not, but I hope it wasn't. But I fear that there might be some truth to it. And in your investigations,
mm-hmm.
if you ever hear of Khan Harang and what happened to it, I'd sure like to know.
Okay, I'll make a note that we'll look
and
into.
And I have
it.
Pictures of Khan Harang too in some of these films, and some of the poor mountain yard women, they look like they're 95 years old, and they're actually probably about 40.
And why is that?
They live such a hard life, and as little as some of them were actually going around babbling. They were crazy.
Because of hard conditions?
I imagine, yeah.
But
they had a lot of adorable kids there that were just sort of full of life, and you know, I don't know what happened to them.
I know.
And do you ever hear of Pat Smith?
No.
She was a surgeon that had a hospital in Khon Tum. She and her staff took, you know, find out where she is, and that's somebody that could give you a wealth of information. She even adopted some mountain yard children. Her name is Pat Smith, had the hospital in Khon Tum. She, if there's a saint on earth, she's one of them. I hope she's still alive.
I want to ask you about the priests. You said that these are the Belgian priests.
Yeah.
That it was an oasis. Is it because of the work they were doing and the attitude they had?
Yeah.
Can you tell a little more?
These were kind, gentle people taking care of children under terrible circumstances.
What kind of a place did they have up there? Can you describe it? The orphanage? Or the buildings they were using?
Well, it was a typical kind of... It was more than ramshackle. It was pretty substantial, as I recall. And you could tell by, you know, just a cursory glance that people were trying to keep it clean and whatnot. And the children didn't seem to be too depressed and mm-hmm. happy and whatnot. I really don't know too much about the physical plant there, but I just know that every time I was there, I felt like, thank God there's somebody doing this good work here.
Were you able to get them supplies on occasion?
Oh, yes. I kept them supplied with flour and rice. I'd give them anything I could. And sometimes it was easier than others. The people that I got a lot of my things from was Catholic Relief. A lot of the relief uh-huh. societies over there.
Uh-huh.
They're all good, but the Catholic Relief could be relied on to give you anything they had at any time. They just wouldn't deliver it.
You had to somehow get it moved.
Yeah, but I have a great admiration for people in CRS, amongst others.
Mm-hmm. Who did you work with in CRS? Do you remember any names?
No.
Any of those people?
No.
Where were they based?
They were based mostly in Saigon.
Anybody up further north?
Yeah, I'm sure there were, but I
not really.
Don't know.
Okay. And Al, how did you get freight from one place to another? How did you arrange that kind of thing?
Well, sometimes it's very difficult. I'll tell you about one place that bothered me especially.
Okay.
It's called Dak Pek, very far north.
Mm-hmm.
In mountains, a lot of people who've been in Vietnam don't even believe me when I tell them this, but the mountains went up to 9,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
In the winter, it was bitter cold. I've even seen ice up there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the J lived, J-E-H. Dr. Hickey knew all about the J.
Mm-hmm.
And during the winter months, when supplies couldn't be dropped to them or flown in, people suffered from malnutrition and whatnot, but mostly from the cold. And young and old died from respiratory diseases. And when you're absolutely... All the kids had, as I recall, was a brass ring around their neck. And I've got pictures of them.
Yeah.
Absolutely naked with a brass ring. Some might have a few raggedy clothes. But a sweater could save lives. And they also had scabies. And scabies is a horrible skin disease, but soap will cure it. Just soap. And I thought, God, if I just get sweaters and soap up here, it'll be a big... But anyway... Getting up there is a problem. Air America did outstanding work over there, but they were not allowed to fly civilian clothes or civilian goods to civilians or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Although we used them for massive airdrops and rescue. But it was difficult getting an Air America plane. And there were American Air Force Caribou, or I guess the Army was flying them, Caribous that we could occasionally get, but it was hard to do because the pilots took their lives in their hands. And you'd have to fly around a mountain and down a valley and around another mountain into another, and finally land at the base of the mountain at Dak Pek, where sometimes they'd come under fire from the North Vietnamese or VC.
Sure.
And Dak Pek was a bad place.
Sure.
And everybody had to live underground all the time. But I had a man that worked for me by the name of Captain Farrell, who was a very important cog in my life, because he knew how to get things done. And he'd get things done sometimes by bribery.
Mm-hmm.
And, everybody is subjected to bribery at this time, right? But there are a lot of troops in Saigon who wanted to go home with a communist weapon. And I came by oodles and oodles of communist weapons, and he'd take truckload of communist weapons down to Saigon, and over a period of time, we'd get the clothes and Catholic Relief, but we would also somehow or another get a caribou to fly up in there when the weather was not. Sometimes the weather was never nice, but we got a few loads up there, but it was by... That mess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You had to do it however you could.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Probably go to jail for some of the things I did.
Do you know what happened to Captain Farrell?
I wish I did.
Really? Do you know how to spell that name?
Yeah, F-A-R-R-E-L-L.
E-L-L, okay.
Hickey. Hickey hated him. I don't know why, but Hickey would know Captain Farrell. I think Captain Farrell was saying something about the mountain yard when Don Hickey overheard him.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the relationship between the mountain yards and the South Vietnamese military, and specifically the mountain yards who had been recruited by American Special Forces people and had very close ties to Americans. I gather, anyway, sometimes did not get along with Arvin. Did you know about incidents like that?
Oh,
or
yes.
Can you remember any of those?
Well, first of all, the relationship of the Vietnamese and mountain yards you know, I'm generalizing. There's all kinds
sure.
of exceptions.
Sure.
But I remember taking Vietnamese colonels and majors up to Song Bay, and they'd see these mountain lions, and boy, he's savage, barbarian. They look down their nose
yeah.
at the mountain lions. The mountain lions resented this because they might do some things in a primitive manner, but they weren't barbarians and savages at all. On the other hand, I met mountain lions, or not mountain lions, but Vietnamese who had great sympathy for them and did what they could for them.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, the mountain lions didn't like the Vietnamese, and the Vietnamese had no use for the mountain lions or knew nothing about them.
Right.
And the average Vietnamese I talked to in the United States didn't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Really?
When I worked with the people called Moi, the mountain lions, and I named them. They live up in the hills, and the people in Saigon, for example, in the triangle, seldom have ever saw one.
Right.
Of course, they did. They were kind of a real curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And there are over a million mountain yards in Vietnam. Not many Vietnamese knew much about them. But, you know, in the old days, the people who became the Vietnamese came out of China. And they settled along the coast, and they came in contact with Aborigines in the mountains. Some of the mountain yard tribes, like the Jirai and the Bunar, were Polynesian people. They came from Polynesia in the early days, and I guess they settled in the lowlands, but when the Chinese, who became the Vietnamese, came down, they moved them up into the hills. Another strain was coming by way from India, by way of Burma, Thailand. These are Mon Khmer people, and they tend to be darker and curlier hair, and but they're a different strain altogether.
The Mon, M-O-N, the Mon
Khmer. M-O-N Khmer, collectively they're
yes.
Mon Khmer,
mm-hmm.
because they go back, I guess, to the Dravidians in India.
Right.
They're dark people with curly hair, as
mm-hmm.
opposed to the Polynesians have straight hair.
Mm-hmm.
And in the old days, there were tribal enmities, and they fought one
sure.
another and whatnot.
Sure.
And there's 39 tribes in Vietnam I know of, and some of them, occasionally I've run across some people who could speak two languages, sure, but not many more than that. And there are people there called the Cham Bunars, a mixture of the Bunar and the Chams. And the Chams in the 8th century were the Viking raiders of the area. They raided the Vietnam and then settled there. And in some of the areas where I worked, these temples came up out of the jungle, these old Cham temples. I don't seem to have ever been investigated or back then by anybody. But interesting people.
Al, did you take a lot of photographs when you were over there of things like this?
I what I took, you have.
Really? Too busy?
I had a Super 8 video camera that, so mostly I took pictures of my feet and inside of my briefcase. And every time I ran across something that really needed documented, the batteries were dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little cheap camera that I used. I wish I'd taken more with a better camera, but I didn't. What I took, you have. And there's in some of those cases, there's old slides and whatnot. That I don't think any of them are any good, but those are the pictures I took.
Well, I'm sure. I'll bet they are pretty good, actually. But we'll see as soon as we get them scanned.
Yeah.
And
I forget what could be on that film. It could be probably a lot of about in art and Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
but maybe family. I don't know.
Okay. Okay.
Whatever.
Okay. At what point on your second time in your second tour, as it were, in Vietnam, did you actually leave the country? When did you leave Vietnam?
Okay, yeah. By this time, Vietnamization was taking over.
Mm-hmm.
And all the time I worked in Vietnam, I was never personally threatened. I was intimidated at times, but never to the point where I was threatened by, say, the South Vietnamese soldiers,
mm-hmm.
or by anybody. But after Vietnamization, things began to break down. And I always had in the back of my mind some army base I could spend the night or eat, have dinner with or something like that, and they began to disappear. And I was becoming more and more isolated. And I guess just before I left there, I was intimidated a couple of times. I was flying refugee. Oh, at Pat Smith's hospital. I'd make arrangements with Khantoum was being attacked. And later on, Quake was attacked, but I didn't know it was going to be attacked. Pat Smith Hospital in Khantoum had an area for the helicopters to land. I had a helicopter. And I had a Jeep in Khantoum. I forget the details now. I had this guy working for me that was going out in the villages rounding up family members, and so I'd stand in a group and be ready to be picked up, flown to Pleiku, which really didn't help him because Pleiku came under attack, and then they had to walk back to Khantoum, I guess. And somebody stuck a gun in his ear and took his Jeep or something like that. We lost the Jeep. And I get a load of mountaineers to fly back to Pleiku. Vietnamese soldiers were getting panicky. It was like anarchy. Everything was breaking down. And they threatened us with weapons and whatnot and fire shots off in the air and whatnot. And several times I was, they tried to run me off the road and I guess rob me and whatnot. But after Vietnamization, and they turned things over to the Vietnamese, and the only Americans were over there were air support. Things were got probably like Iraq today. Everybody seemed to turn against us.
And all the American military people had to be out after a
The American military was pulling out, and the military left there were mostly the pilots and the people that could provide air support to the South Vietnamese Army, who was now supposed to be taking over. But it was pretty hairy. But John Van stayed there until he got killed. And towards the end, it was John Van himself who was directing the war. He's the one calling in the bombers and whatnot. I don't know the details. I wasn't there at that time, but John Van was still top man in Vietnam and was doing the general's job. I think he got buried as a general. Didn't he?
I believe he had full military honors, yeah.
As a
BG.
Yeah.
I think it was pretty
rare. I was told I had the same rank as a full colonel, I know that whatever rank we were called active duty, whatever rank we had, and while you're with Corps, it would still valid, and your promotions meant something. But you can only receive a pension from one government service, and you had to, if you wanted to take advantage of the State Department retirement, you had to forego your Air Force retirement and military benefits and whatnot. You'd make a little bit more money, and I guess some people, maybe Van did it, I don't know. But I thought, well, I get along fine now. I'm not concerned about rank or any more money, and I never applied for it, but I think technically this Van was called a brigadier general. I could be called a full colonel if I pushed it, but I never pursued it.
So you wanted to, just to be clear, you wanted to stay with the military retirement benefits and all, rather than the state.
Yeah, because I was told some people got tried to do this and they eventually got it, but they're for maybe a year or a year, they didn't get anything.
Really?
And that would have really screwed things up.
Yeah. Now, how long did you stay in Vietnam? Were you there in 74? Did you leave
no,
in 73?
I was home in 73.
73? Okay.
Yeah. I went back to teaching school.
Okay. When you left, I'm sure had to say goodbye to people. Was that tough?
It was, especially the mountain yards I knew and worked with. But saying goodbye to the bureaucracy is
not so hard.
There are a lot of people involved, but everybody's doing their own thing, and and close friendships were few and far between. Mm-hmm. I don't remember even saying goodbye to Frenchie, though I guess I did.
Was it tough to leave Vietnam under those difficult circumstances in 1973?
Pardon?
Was it tough to leave Vietnam itself and not know when you could come back or under what circumstances?
No, I don't remember any problems associated along those lines. I was happy to leave. My job, as I mentioned before, was kind of meaningless because I was just sitting in the office working with the Hess report, mm-hmm. other reports, listening to briefings, and sometimes giving a briefing that I really didn't think much of. And I was happy to leave. I one of these books, I said, if things don't get any better, I'm going to leave. But I was happy to leave.
And you came back to San Antonio then, is that right? And
yes.
The family all came back as well, I assume. Mm-hmm. And then you began teaching again.
I picked up where I left off.
Okay.
I taught Russian and world cultures at the high school level, and I taught spoken Japanese at night.
In the
junior
community
college.
At the junior college, uh-huh.
And then because in 1975, the government of Russia and the United States came up with the idea of détente, let's ease tensions a bit by cultural exchanges, and I was one of the first picked. And I went off to the Soviet Union to teach in the university.
Where did you go exactly?
I went to the city of, Americans call it Kiev, but it's Kiev,
mm-hmm.
in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And there I met a lot of really nice people that all were dedicated communists at that time. They all were suspicious of me. They knew I'd been a former military man. They couldn't envision anybody having two careers. They thought I was an Asian provocateur.
Yeah,
and
sure.
The administration didn't want us there. There were three of us there. Didn't want us there, but had to because it came down from on high.
Mm-hmm.
And all the teachers were told to be nice to the Americans, but don't get too close to them. Because they're all Asian provocateurs. We were told don't get too cozy with any of the teachers because some of them have connections with the KGB. And so we were nice to one another and formal and aloof and whatnot. But over a period of time, none of us could keep it up.
Mm-hmm.
Because to keep an eye on us, there's a duty roster. Irina Ivanova will escort Professor Lavelle to the opera, the theater, the ballet, or whatnot, and Margarita Petrovna will take so-and-so. And so even at night, we were kept busy so they could keep their eyes on us.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't off having any kind
and
of
so
meetings?
During these sojourns at night, we interrelated, and they'd meet us in front of the hotel where we stayed, and we'd go off to the theater, the ballet, and they'd drop us off in front of the hotel, and no chance for any complicated maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
And what was I going to say about that?
That they were keeping watch on you? And
they kept a watch on us. And
anyway, it broke down.
Oh, where it broke down was in the teacher's lounge.
Uh-huh.
All the teachers would bring in goodies from home, and we'd kind of picnic together in the teacher's lounge. And we didn't become friendly at all, but there were groups there that we got to know very well, and there four especially. And I remember saying to him, if you ever get a chance to come to the United States and get to New York, send me a telegram and I'll send you a ticket to Texas and back. Not knowing, well, if I thought about it, I'd probably know, but I wasn't expecting the Soviet Union to collapse. So when it collapsed, I started getting telegrams.
Mm-hmm.
And three of these people were in New York. One of them was named Rima Putalina, who came over with the Ukrainian Children's Choir, and she was given a 2-week leave of absence, and I had her down in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was a KGB man named Slava Fomorenko contacted me, and he was one of our mentors, but his job was to report on us.
Mm-hmm.
But he did it with grace and whatnot, and he He was a sensible sort of guy. I invited him down. He's in the, living in the States now.
Is he? Whereabouts do you know?
In Minnesota, Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
His daughter had married an American, and they both have good jobs. And then there was my wife, her name was Margarita Kudashova Petrovna Belarus. And she was the oldest teacher of the group, but she's a lively little lady that intrigued me because she's so interested in everybody and everything and seemed to be so kind and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
We never had any kind of a relationship other than I taught her classes and I knew her and she knew me. But after my wife died, after about a year, I was not designed by nature to be alone. And I was getting very lonely and I was getting morose.
Yeah.
And I bought that airplane when I cracked up. I think subconsciously. I didn't want to commit suicide, but I didn't care if something happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was in that frame of mind.
Yeah.
But somebody told Margarita that my wife had died, and she sent me a letter of consolation.
Mm-hmm.
And because by this time you could send stuff back and forth. Before
sure.
We'd try it, and it'd be confiscated and whatnot. And I wonder if that little lady I met would like to take a trip with me out to Colorado. Because I wanted to visit my old stomping ground and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Like, your old haunts.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I wrote her a letter. And I invited her over here. And I know that she was a proper, old-fashioned lady. And I said, as long as you're staying in my house, you'll have your own bedroom and bath. And I certainly won't pose a threat to you. And when we're on the road, you at least have your own bed. And anyway, she talked over with her family and they said, go for it, Granny.
She was how old about at this at that
well,
point?
About as old, 2 years younger than me. And at that time, this was, I'm 84 now, so I guess I was 74, 75.
So she was in her early 70s.
She's a little gray-haired, wrinkled little lady, yeah. And I forgot what I forgot what she looked like. And I wrote to her and asked her to send me a photograph.
She's gorgeous.
And yeah, but she sent me a picture of her with three other old ladies, and I didn't know which one was.
Oh, her. Really? You couldn't pick her out.
And I thought, God, she's trying to forget how old I am and so forth. Anyways, I was worried to death, and she got here with no trouble at all. I got lost going to the airport in San Antonio. And, I went to the upper level, and she was getting off on the lower level, and we had trouble making contact, and I lost the keys to the car. And, dropped him in the dark and couldn't even. Anyway, I finally got.
Were you nervous?
I was nervous, yes. I even had a sign written in Russian, Margarita Etheya. And I had my name in Australia. And she spotted me finally and came over laughing because I'd made a mistake. But then I was apprehensive about, I wonder how long she's going to be here and can we stand one another for a whole week? And anyway, we started on our trip, and suddenly I began to relax, and I began to see America through her eyes.
She had never been to the States
before. I was
before,
a typical spoiled American. I took a lot for granted and criticized when I shouldn't, I guess. And all she saw was beauty. It's just sad to think about it.
That's okay.
Do
you want to continue?
Yeah.
Okay.
She couldn't get over the beautiful roads and the fact that a militia man didn't stop us
so often. Mm-hmm.
And that no matter how far we drove, there's always a decent place to stay and a decent place to sleep and a place with a swimming pool and a place to eat. And she said even the livestock over here are happy because in Ukraine they hobble their cows and their horses, keep them wandering. And the poor things are unhappy.
Of course.
But here she'd see cows under the trees and what in the shade munching their cud and whatnot. And I began to appreciate what I didn't before. And she's had that effect on me. I don't know what I would have done without her.
She made you happy again.
Yeah. So happy I'm crying.
Al, let's take a break.
Yeah. God, I didn't know I was at the